to Sorry's. Good taste all round. Chert was a pig. Sorry stiffened. Her hand slipped down beneath her cloak. Easy, girl, Amy said in a low tone. We ain't wagging tongues. Around here, you take care of yourselves first. And I don't want no knife in my eye. We said we'd take care of you, didn't we?
The ale arrived as ordered. Sorry raised a hand and closed it on the tankard's handle.
You don't want to take care of me, Meese, she said quietly.
Another person arrived on Meese's other side. Glancing at him, Sorry saw that it was the black-haired youth, his face pale.
Damn it, Meese, he hissed. I'm having a really bad day.
Meese chuckled and draped an arm over his shoulders.
Scurv, serve us up a couple of them Gredfallen ales. Crocus here's earned the Rugistan's best.
Meese turned her head and bent close to Sorry again.
Next time, she whispered, you don't want to show that kind of breeding. Not around here, anyway.
Sorry frowned down at her drink. She had been careless, ordering the city's best. Then she took a mouthful.
That's fine, she said. Fine indeed.
Meese grinned, nudging Crocus.
The lady likes it just fine.
Crocus leaned forward, offering Sorry a weary but warm smile. From outside came the klaxon of the guard. Scurve served up two ales. Sorry watched Crocus's gaze move down her body, then stop. The youth's smile tightened, his face whitening even more than before. As the tankard was set before him, Crocus averted his eyes and reached for it.
Pay up before you drink that, Crocus, Scurve muttered. You're getting to be just as bad as Crupper.
Crocus reached into his pocket and pulled out a handful of coins. As he tried to count them, some slipped between his fingers and bounced on the bar. Of the three that fell, two clattered briefly, then stopped. The third coin spun and continued spinning. Sorry's eyes swung to it, as did Scurve's and Meese's. Crocus reached for it, then hesitated. The coin was still spinning, its momentum unchanged. Sorry stared at the coin, feeling echoes of power slam into her skull like ocean waves. From within, all at once, came an answering surge. Scurve shouted as the coin skidded across the bar, bounced once high into the air, then clattered to a stop directly in front of Crocus. No one spoke. Beyond their small ring, no one else had witnessed the event. Crocus thrust his hand forward and collected the coin.
Not this one, he grated.
Fine,
Scurve answered in a similar, hoarse voice. He reached, shaking hands, to gather in the other coins Crocus had laid on the bar. Beneath the counter, Sorry brushed her hand against her dagger's hilt and scabbard. It came away wet. So, Crocus had seen the blood. She would have to kill him. Only, her frown deepened, she knew she wouldn't.
Crocus, my boy!
Came a shout from under the gallery. Meese sneered in that direction.
The flopping fish himself, she muttered. Crupper calls, lad.
Crocus snorted, having returned the coin to his pocket. He picked up his tankard.
Later, Meese.
So, she had found Opon's man, as easily as that. And he was connected to Crupper somehow. This was almost too simple. It made her suspicious.
A likely lad, Meese said.
Me and a realtor. We look out for him, right?
Sorry leaned against the bar, her eyes on the tankard in her hand. She'd have to play this very carefully. That burst of shadow sorcery, responding to the coin's influence, had been entirely instinctive.
Right, Meese, she said. No worries on that count.
Okay.
Meese sighed. Okay, let's try for the cheap stuff now. Scurve? Daru beer, if you please. Earthenware, if you have it.
Crouched against the second-tier wall on the lakefront side was Quip's Bar, a common haunt of shipmen and fisher hands. The bar's walls were cut sandstone, and over time the whole edifice had developed a backward lean, as if withdrawing from the front street. Quips now sagged against the second-tier wall, as did the adjoining squatter shacks, constructed mostly of driftwood and hull planks, washed ashore from the occasional wreck out on Mole's Reef. Dusk brought a light rain to Darujistan, the mists crawling in from the water and onto the shore. Far out over the lake, lightning flashed, but too distant for thunder to be heard. Kalam emerged from Quip's bar just as a local greyface brought his burning pitchstick to a nearby gaslight, having moments earlier opened the copper valves. The lamp ignited in a flash of blue flame that quickly evened out. Kalam paused outside the bar to watch the odd, grey-robed man continue on down the street. He squinted skyward, then moved up the street. He came to the last squatter shack, this one abutting a peculiar jag in the tier wall, and entered. Quick Ben looked up from his cross-legged position in the center of the dirt floor.
"Any luck?"
"No," Kalam said. "The guild's gone to ground."
"Why? I've no idea."
He went to the far wall and sat down on his bedroll. He leaned back against the ancient pitted stone and eyed his comrade.
"You think maybe the city council's moved to take out the local assassins?"
Quick Ben's gaze glittered in the gloom.
"You mean anticipating we'd try to make contact?"
Kalam looked away. "I doubt they're idiots. They must know it's the Malazan way. Offer the guild a contract it can't refuse. Then sit back and watch the rulers drop, like headless flies. Whiskey Jack suggested the plan. Dujek okayed it. Those two were talking the old emperor's language there, Quick. The old man must be laughing in the abyss right now."
The wizard shivered.
"An unpleasant image."
Shrugging, Kalam continued. "It's all academic anyway, if we can't find a local assassin. Wherever they are, it's not in Lakefront District, I'd swear to that. The only name I picked up that's got mystery around it is someone named the Eel. Not an assassin, though. Something else."
"Where next, then?"
Quick Ben asked.
"Kadrubi District?"
"No, just a bunch of farmers and herders there. Hood knows the smell alone coming from that place is enough to cross it off the list. We'll try Daru, starting tomorrow."
Kalam hesitated.
"What about your side of things?"
Quick Ben bowed his head. When he answered, it was a faint whisper.
"Almost ready."
"Whiskey Jack nearly choked when he heard your proposal. So did I. You'll be walking into the viper's den, Quick. You sure it's necessary?"
"No."
Quick Ben looked up.
"Personally, I'd rather we just dropped everything and ran. Away from it all. From the Empire. From Darujistan. From war. But try convincing the sergeant to do that. He's loyal to an idea. And that's the hardest kind to turn."
Kalam nodded.
"Honor, integrity, all that expensive crap."
"Right. So we do it this way because it's the only way left to us. Hairlock's insanity has become a liability, but we can use him still one last time. Power draws power, and with luck, Hairlock's demise will do just that. The more ascendants we can lure into the fray, the better."
"I always thought that was something to avoid, Quick."
The wizard's smile was strained.
"Tell me about it. But right now, the more confusion and chaos, the better."
"And if Taishren catches wind?"
Quick Ben's smile broadened.
"Then we're dead all that much sooner. So it goes."
Kalam barked a short, humorless laugh.
"So it goes."
The wizard cocked his head.
"The sun's past the horizon. Time to start."
"You want me out of here?"
Kalam asked. Quick Ben shook his head.
"No, I want you right where you are for this one. If I don't come back, take my body and burn it down to ash. Scatter the ash to the four winds and curse my name with all your heart.
Kalam was silent. Then he asked in a growl, How long do I wait?
Dawn, Quick Ben replied. You understand, I would only ask this of my closest friend.
I understand. Now, get on with it, damn it.
Quick Ben gestured. A ring of fire sprang from the earth, surrounding the wizard. He closed his eyes. To Kalam, his friends seemed to deflate slightly, as if something essential to life had disappeared. Quick Ben's neck creaked as his chin sank down to his chest. His shoulders slumped, and a long breath escaped with a slow hiss. The ring of fire flared, then dimmed to a lapping glimmer on the earth. Kalam shifted position, stretching out his legs and crossing his arms. In the gathering silence, he waited. A pale Murillo returned to the table and sat down.
Someone's disposing of the body, he said, then shook his head. Whoever killed Chert was a professional with a real nasty streak, right through the eye.
Enough! Crupper cried out, raising his hands.
Crupper happens to be eating, dear Murillo, and Crupper also happens to have a delicate stomach. Chert was a fool, Murillo continued, ignoring Crupper, but hardly the type to attract such viciousness.
Crocus said nothing. He had seen the blood on that dark-haired woman's dagger.
Who can say? Crupper waggled his eyebrows. Perhaps he was witness to some horrific horror. Perhaps he was stamped out as a man crushes a cute mouse underfoot.
Crocus glanced around. His eyes returned to the woman standing with Meese at the bar. Dressed in leather armor with a plain dueling sword strapped to her hip, she reminded him of the time he'd watched, as a young boy, a troop of mercenaries ride through the city. They had been the Crimson Guard, he recalled, 500 men and women without a shiny buckle among them. His gaze remained on the woman. Like a mercenary, a killer for whom killing had long since lost its horror. What had Chert done to earn a knife in the eye? Crocus looked away, in time to see Ralik Nom enter the bar. The assassin approached the table, seemingly unconscious of the locals moving from his path. Coll intercepted him before he reached the table. The burly man slapped Ralik's back and leaned drunkenly against him.
Nom, you old bastard.
Ralik threw an arm around Cole's round shoulders, and together they came to the table. Crupper looked up.
Oh, my dear comrades, Crupper invites you to join our familiar gathering.
Waving his arms at the two empty chairs, he rocked back in his seat.
To bring you up to date on our dramatic doings, the lad Crocus has been staring dreamily into space while Murillo and Crupper have discussed the latest natterings of the street rats.
Coll remained standing, weaving unsteadily, a frown knitting his brows. Ralik sat down and reached for the pitcher of beer.
What natterings are those?
The assassin asked casually.
The rumor that we've now allied with Moonspawn, Murillo said. Nonsense, of course, Crupper said. Have you seen anything to suggest such a thing?
Murillo grinned.
The moon hasn't moved away, has it? Not only that, there's that council tent stationed directly under it.
Crocus spoke up.
I heard from Uncle Mammoth that the councilmen haven't had any luck getting a message to whoever's in Moonspawn.
Typical,
Murillo commented, his eyes narrowing briefly on Ralik.
Who lives in there? Crocus asked.
Coll tottered and threw both hands down on the table to steady himself. He thrust his red face at Crocus and bellowed,
Five black dragons!
Within the Warren of Chaos, Quick Ben knew of the innumerable shifting pathways that led to doors. Though he called them doors, they were in fact barriers created where Warrens touched, a Calcretian of energy, as solid as basalt. Chaos touched on all realms with gnarled fingertips bleeding power. The doors hardened wounds in the flesh of other worlds, other avenues of magic. The wizard had focused his talents on such doors. While within the Warren of Chaos, he had learned the ways of shaping their energy. He had found means of altering the barriers, of sensing what lay beyond them. Each Warren of magic possessed a smell, each realm a texture. And though the pathways he took were never the same as those he had taken before, he had mastered the means of finding those he sought. He travelled now down one of those paths, a track of nothingness enclosed by the Warren's own accretions, twisting and fraught with contradictions. On one trail, he'd will himself forward, yet find himself moving back. He'd come to a sharp right turn, followed by another, then yet another, all in the same direction. He knew it was the power of his mind that opened the pathways, but they had their own laws, or perhaps they were his, yet unknown to him. Whatever the source of the shaping, it was madness to find. He came at last to the door he sought. The barrier showed as nothing more than a dull, slate-gray stone. Hovering before it, Quickben whispered a command, and his spirit took the form of his own body. He stood a moment, mastering the disconnected tremble of his ghost body, then stepped forward and laid hands on the door. Its edges were hard and warm. Toward the center it grew hot and soft to the touch. The surface slowly lost its opaqueness beneath the wizard's hands, becoming glassy like obsidian. Quickben closed his eyes. He had never before sought to pass through such a door. He was not even certain that it was possible. And if he survived into the beyond, was there any way to return? Past the mechanics of the one thing loomed his final, most difficult worry. He was about to attempt entry into a realm where he wasn't welcome. Quickben opened his eyes.
"I am direction," he said quietly.
He leaned against the barrier.
"I am the power of will, in a place that respects this, and only this."
He leaned harder.
"I am the Warren's touch. To chaos, nothing is immune. Nowhere is immune."
He felt the door begin to yield. He lashed out one hand behind him, fending off a growing pressure.
"Only I shall pass," he hissed.
Abruptly, with a strange thumping sound, he slipped through, energy flaring around his body. The wizard staggered over rough, parched earth. He regained his balance and looked around. He stood on a barren plain, the horizon off to his left humped with low hills. Overhead spanned a sky the color of quicksilver, a scatter of long, stringy clouds moving in unison and black as ink directly above. Quickben sat down, folding his legs and clasping his hands in his lap.
"Shadow Throne," he said. "Lord of Shadows, I am come to your realm. Will you receive my presence as befits a peaceful visitor?"
From the hills came an answer, the howling of hounds. Chapter 12. Walk with me on Thieves' Road. Hear its song underfoot, how clear its tone in misstep, as it sings you in two. Absalar's Cant, Drisbin, born 1135. Kneading his brow, Crupper sat reading in Mammoth's study.
"And in the calling down to earth, the god was crippled, and so chained in its place. In the calling down, many lands were sundered by the god's fists, and things were born and things were released. Chained and crippled was this god."
Crupper glanced up from the ancient tome and rolled his eyes.
"Brevity! Crupper prays for brevity!"
He returned to the faded handwritten script.
"And it bred caution in the unveiling of its powers. The crippled god bred caution, but not well enough. for the powers of the earth came to it in the end. Chained was the crippled god, and so chained was it destroyed. And upon this barren plain that imprisoned the crippled god, many gathered to the deed. Hood, grey wanderer of death, was among the gathering, as was Decembri, then Hood's warrior. Though it was here, and in this time, that Decembri shattered the bonds Hood held upon him. Also among the gathering were... Crupper groaned and flipped pages. The list seemed interminable, absurdly long. From this account, he half expected to see his grandmother's name among those listed. Finally, after 3 pages, he found the names he sought. And among those that came from the vaulted heavens of silver, the Tista Andii, dwellers of darkness in the place before light, black dragons numbering 5, and in their league sailed red-winged Silana, said to dwell among the Tista Andii in their fang of darkness descending from the vaulted heavens of silver.
Crupper nodded, muttering to himself. A descending fang of darkness? Moonspawn? Home to 5 black dragons and 1 red dragon? He shivered. How had Cole come upon this? True, the man hadn't always been a drunken lout, but even his past station, lofty as it was, hadn't been the scholarly kind. Who then had spoken through the old man's wine-stained mouth?
That, Crupper sighed to himself, shall have to wait its answer. The significance, however, of Cole's bellowed claim lies in its evident truth, and as to how it pertains to the present situation.
He closed the book and rose to his feet. Behind him he heard footsteps.
"I've brought you herbal tea,"
the old man said, as he entered the closet-sized room.
"Has Aladart's realm compendium been beneficial, Crupper?"
"Beneficial indeed,"
Crupper said, gratefully accepting the earthenware mug.
"Crupper has learned the value of modern language. Such long-lipped dribbles common to those ancient scholars are a curse. Crupper is thankful to find extinct in our time."
"Aha,"
the old man said, coughing slightly and looking away.
"Well, do you mind if I ask what you were seeking?"
Crupper glanced up, the corners of his eyes crinkling slightly.
"Not at all, Mammoth. I thought to find mention of my grandmother's name."
Mammoth frowned, then nodded.
"I see. Well, I'll not inquire as to your luck, then."
"Please do not,"
Crupper said, eyes widening.
"Luck is such a dreadful companion these days, with all awry as all happens to be. But thank you for understanding Crupper's need for circumspection."
"Not at all," Mammoth said, waving one hand. "I didn't mean to... Well, yes, I did. Curiosity, you understand, the intellectual kind."
Crupper smiled beatifically and sipped tea.
"Well," Mammoth said, "shall we return to the common room then and find respite before the hearth?"
They strode into the other chamber. Once seated, Crupper stretched out his legs and leaned back.
"How has your writing been coming along?"
he asked.
"Slow," Mammoth answered. "As one would expect, of course."
It seemed Mammoth was working up to something, and so Crupper waited, idly wiggling his toes. A minute passed. Then the old man cleared his throat and spoke.
"Crupper, have you seen much of my dear nephew lately?"
Crupper raised his eyebrows.
"Long ago," he said, "Crupper made a promise to a man, the man being a concerned uncle to a young boy who found the streets an exciting playground. I, the lad, dreamed of sword fights and dark deeds committed in alleys on behalf of princesses in disguise, or some such thing."
Mammoth was nodding, his eyes closed.
"And to such promises, Crupper has availed of himself thoroughly, for he, too, loved the boy. And, as with any endeavour, survival is measured in ability, and so did Crupper take the lad under his silken wing, with some success, yes?"
Mammoth smiled, still nodding.
"And so, to answer the uncle's question, indeed, Crupper has seen the lad."
Mammoth leaned forward and fixed Crupper with an intense gaze.
Have you seen anything odd in his actions? I mean, has he asked you any strange questions, made any requests?
Crupper's eyes narrowed. He paused to drink.
Bluntly? Yes. For one, he sought the return of a fine cache of jewelry he acquired recently, for personal reasons, as he said.
Personal reasons?
Crupper wondered then, and wonders now. But the lad's seeming sincerity, nay, focused intensity, struck Crupper as laudable.
Agreed. Would you believe Crocus has now expressed an interest in formal education? I can't understand it. The boy's positively obsessed about something.
Perhaps, then, Crupper should piece this together.
Thank you, Mammoth said, relieved. I would know where all this is coming from. So much ambition all at once. I fear it may soon burn itself out. If we can nourish it, however...
By all means, Crupper said. There is more to life than petty thievery, after all.
Mammoth grinned.
Why, Crupper? I'm surprised to hear that coming from you.
Oh, such comments are better left between you and Crupper. In any case, I believe Murillo knows something of all this. He intimated as much this evening while we dined at the Phoenix Inn.
Mammoth asked, Is Murillo well?
Crupper smiled. The net about the lad remains intact, he said. For one, Ralik Nom has taken the responsibility seriously indeed. Mayhap he sees something of his own lost youth in Crocus. In truth, Ralik is a man whose true nature escapes Crupper. Fiercely loyal, for certain, and one who, as you well know, honors his debts with such vigor as to humble those around him, excepting Crupper, naturally. Yet is it blood that travels his veins? One must wonder at times.
A distant look had entered Mammoth's face. Crupper tensed. The air smelled of magic. He leaned forward and studied the old man seated across from him. Someone was communicating with Mammoth, and the warren that now pulsed in the room was familiar to Crupper. He sat back and waited. Eventually, Mammoth got swiftly to his feet.
I have some research to do, he said distractedly. As for you, Crupper, Master Baruch wishes to speak with you immediately.
I thought I sensed the alchemist's presence, Crupper said, rising with a soft grunt. Ah, the rigors of these fated nights ever urge us on. Until later then, Mammoth.
Goodbye,
the scholar said, a frown on his face as he crossed the room. He entered the small chamber where Crupper had spent the past hour. Crupper adjusted the sleeves of his cloak. Whatever had happened, it had been enough to jar Mammoth's etiquette, and that alone hinted at dire events.
Well, he murmured, best not keep Baruch waiting then. At least, he amended as he headed for the door, not for too long. Decorum demands that Crupper retain his sense of dignity. He shall walk fast, yes, but walk he shall. For Crupper needs time to think, to plan, to scheme, to anticipate, to backtrack with some thoughts, to leap ahead with others, to do all the things necessary. First and foremost, Crupper must discern the nature of the woman who followed him, and who killed Chert, and who noted that Crocus saw the blood on her weapon, and who marked Ralik Nom as an assassin with his very arrival. She might well provide the key to everything and more, for the coin did indeed turn its face upon her, if only for a moment. And that, thinks Crupper, shall return to us all, for good or ill.
He stopped and looked around, blinking rapidly.
At the very least, he muttered, Crupper should leave Mammoth's room.
He glanced back at the chamber Mammoth had entered. From within came the sounds of brittle pages being rapidly turned. Crupper sighed in relief, then left. Crone ruffled her singed feathers and hopped about in agitation. Where was that alchemist? She had 1,000 things to attend to before the night was done, though in truth she couldn't think of any of them. Nevertheless, she disliked being kept waiting. The door to the study opened, and Baruch strode through, gathering a robe about his considerable bulk.
"My apologies, Crone. I was otherwise indisposed."
Crone grunted. Sorcery trailed from the man in thick, pungent streams.
"My master, Lord Anamanda Rake," she said without preamble, "has commanded that I tell you what I told him of my adventures on the Rivi Plain."
Baruch came up to where the great Revan paced on the map table. The alchemist frowned.
"You've been injured."
"Pride, no more. Hearken then to my story."
Baruch raised an eyebrow. The old witch's mood was dark. He fell silent and she began.
"A small wooden puppet approaches from the north, a creation of soul-shifting and sourced from a warren of chaos. Its power is immense, twisted, malign even to great ravens. It killed many of my kin as it slipped in and out of its warren. It evidently took pleasure in such acts."
Crone snapped her beak in anger, then continued.
"It pursues a power I could not approach, and whatever this power, it strikes directly for the Gadrubi Hills. My lord and I are agreed in this. The power seeks something within those hills, yet we are not native to this land. Hence, we bring this news to you, alchemist. Two forces are converging on the Gadrobi Hills. My lord asks you why."
Baruch's face had lost all its color. He turned slowly and walked to a chair. Sitting down, he steepled his hands before his face and closed his eyes.
"The Malazan Empire seeks something it cannot hope to control, something buried within the Gadrobi Hills. Whether or not either force is capable of freeing that thing is another matter. Seeking is not the same as finding, and finding is not the same as succeeding."
Crone hissed impatiently.
"Who is buried there, alchemist?"
"A Jaghut tyrant, imprisoned by the Jaghut themselves. Generations of scholars and sorcerers have sought to find this barrow. None managed to discover even so much as a clue."
Baruch looked up, his expression lined with worry.
"I know of one man here in Darujistan who has gathered all the available knowledge concerning this burial place. I must confer with him. I can give your lord this, however. There lies a standing stone in the Gadrobi Hills. I know its location precisely. It is almost invisible. Only its weathered top breaks the ground, perhaps a hand's span in height. The remaining 20 feet are beneath the earth. You will see the remnants of many pits and trenches that have been excavated around it, all fruitless. For while the stone marks the beginning point, it is not the entrance to the barrow."
"Where, then, is this entrance?"
"That I will not tell you. Once I speak with my colleague, perhaps I can give you more details. Perhaps not. But the means by which the barrow is entered must remain a secret."
"This avails us nothing. My lord..."
"Is extremely powerful," Baruch cut in. "His intentions are anything but clear, Crone, no matter that we are allied. What lies within that barrow can destroy a city, this city. That I will not allow to enter Rake's hands. You shall have the location of the standing stone, for it is there that the hunters must first go. I have one question to ask, Crone. This puppet, are you certain it pursues this other power?"
Crone bobbed her head.
"It tracks, it hides when necessary. You assume both powers are Malazan. Why?"
Baruch grunted.
First, they want Darujistan. They'll do anything to win it. They've had access to vast libraries among the lands they've conquered. The Jaghut Barrow is no secret in and of itself. Second, you said both powers came down from the north. They can only be Malazan. Why one hides from the other is beyond me, though I wouldn't doubt that there are competing factions within the empire. Any political entity as large as that one is bound to be rife with discord. In any case, they pose a direct threat to Darujistan, and by extension, to your lord's desires to prevent the Malazan Empire from conquering us. Assuming that the powers are Malazan seems warranted. Crone's displeasure was obvious.
You will be kept informed of the activities on the Rivi Plain. My lord must decide whether to intercept these powers before they reach the Gadrubi Hills.
She turned an angry eye on Baruch.
He has received little assistance from his allies. I trust when we next speak, that situation will be remedied.
The alchemist shrugged. My first meeting with Anomander Rake has proved my only meeting with him. Assistance demands communication. His tone hardened. Inform your lord that the present dissatisfaction exists with us as much as it does with him.
My lord has been busy with his side of things, Crone muttered, flapping to the windowsill.
Baruch stared at the bird as she prepared to leave. Busy? He asked darkly. In what way?
In due time, alchemist,
Crone purred. A moment later she was gone. Baruch cursed, and with an angry gesture returned the window to its place and slammed the shutters. Doing this through magic and from a distance was not as satisfying as it would have been had he done it physically. Grumbling, he rose and walked to the mantelpiece. As he poured himself some wine, he paused. Less than half an hour ago, he had conjured a demon. It was not an ambitious conjuring. He had needed a spy, not a killer. Something told him he'd be calling upon far deadlier creatures in the near future. He scowled, then took a mouthful of wine. Mammut, he whispered as he opened his warren. I need you. He smiled as a scene appeared in his head, of a small room on a stone hearth. Seated in the chair opposite his point of view was Crupper. Good. I need you both. The hound that approached Quick Ben was wide and heavy, its fur a pasty white. As it trotted up to the wizard, he saw that its eyes were also white. The creature possessed no pupils. It stopped a short distance away and sat. Quick Ben bowed.
You are the hound called Blind, he said, mate to Baron and mother of Gear. I come seeking no harm. I would speak with your master.
He heard a growl beside him and froze. Slowly he turned his head and looked down. Less than a foot from his right leg lay another hound, mottled brown and tan, lean and scarred. Its eyes were fixed on Blind.
Baron, he nodded.
Another growl answered Baron's, this one behind the wizard. He turned further to see, 10 feet away, a third hound, this one long, black and sleek. Its eyes fixed on him, glowed red.
And Shan, he said quietly.
He faced Blind again.
Have you found your quarry, or are you my escort?
Baron rose silently beside him, its shoulders level with his chest. Blind stood, then trotted off to the left. She stopped and looked behind. Twin growls spurred Quick Ben after them. The land around them changed slowly, details slipping into sourceless shadows and re-emerging subtly altered. On what the wizard thought of as the north horizon, a grey forest climbed a slope to what might have been a wall.
This wall was in place of sky. Maybe it was sky. But to Quick Ben, it looked strangely close, even though the forest was leagues away. Glancing overhead did not help him confirm or refute his feeling that this realm was bordered by a magical wall, for it, too, seemed close, almost within reach. Yet black clouds rode winds above him, skewing his perceptions and making him dizzy. Another hound had joined their company. This one, a male, was dark grey, one of its eyes blue, the other yellow. Though it didn't come close, Quick Ben judged that it was the largest of those around him, and its movement hinted at deadly speed. He knew it as Doan, firstborn to the pack's leader, Rude, and its first mate, Palik. Doan trotted alongside Blind for a time, then, when they came to the crest of a low rise, he bolted forward. Reaching the crest, Quick Ben saw their destination. He sighed. Just as the image carved upon the altar within the temples dedicated to Shadow Throne, Shadow Keep rose from the plain like an enormous lump of black glass, fractured with curving planes, rippled in places, with some corners glistening white as if crushed. The largest surface facing them, a wall, he supposed, was mottled and dull, as if it was a cortex, the weathered surface of obsidian. There were no windows as such, but many of the slick surfaces looked semi-translucent and seemed to glow with an inner light. As far as Quick Ben could see, there was no door, no gate, no drawbridge. They arrived, and the wizard exclaimed in surprise as Blind strode into the stone and disappeared. He hesitated, and Baron came as close to nudging him as Quick Ben allowed. He walked up to the mottled stone and held out his hands as he stepped into it. He felt nothing, passing through effortlessly, to find himself in a hallway that could have been found in any mundane estate. Barren of trappings, the corridor led straight forward for perhaps 30 feet and ended at double doors. Blind and Doan sat to either side of these doors, which now opened of their own accord. Quick Ben entered the room beyond. The chamber was domed. Opposite him stood a simple obsidian throne on a slightly raised dais. The dull, cobbled floor bore no rugs, and the walls were bare except for torches spaced every 10 feet. Quick Ben counted 40, but the light was fitful, seeming to struggle against encroaching shadows. At first he thought the throne unoccupied, but as he approached, he saw the figure seated there. It seemed composed of almost translucent shadows, vaguely human in form, but hooded, preventing even the glint of eyes. Still, Quick Ben could feel the god's attention fixed solely on him, and he barely repressed a shiver. Shadow Throne spoke, his voice calm and clear.
"Shan tells me you know the names of my hounds."
Quick Ben stopped before the dais. He bowed.
"I was once an acolyte within your temple, Lord."
The god was silent for a time, then he said,
"Is it wise to admit such a thing, wizard? Do I look kindly upon those who once served me, but then abandoned my ways? Tell me, I would hear from you what my priests teach." "To begin upon the path of shadow, and then to leave it, is rewarded by the rope."
"Meaning?"
"I am marked for assassination by all who follow your ways, Lord." "Yet here you stand, wizard."
Quick Ben bowed again.
"I would strike a deal, Lord."
The god giggled, then raised a hand.
"No, Dishan, strike naught."
Quick Ben stiffened. The black hound stepped around him and ascended the dais. She lay down before her god and eyed the wizard blankly.
"Do you know why I just saved your life, wizard?"
"I do, Lord."
Shadow Throne leaned forward.
"Shan wants you to tell me."
Quick Ben met the hound's red stare.
"Shadow Throne loves deals."
The god sighed and sank back.
"Acolyte, indeed. Well then, wizard, speak on. while you can.
I must begin with a question, Lord.
Ask it.
Does Geir still live?
Shan's eyes flared, and she half rose before the god's hand touched her head.
Now that, Shadowthrone said, is quite a question. You've managed something few, alas, have been able to do. Wizard, my curiosity is piqued. So, I answer you, yes, Geir survives. By all means, continue.
Lord, I would deliver into your hands the one who offended your hound.
How? He belongs to Opon.
Not him, Lord, but the one who led Geir to that chamber. The one who sought to take Geir's soul, and would have succeeded if not for Opon's mortal tool.
In exchange for what?
Quickben cursed inwardly. He could read nothing from the god's tone, and that made things even trickier than he'd expected.
My life, Lord. I wish the rope's reward lifted from me.
Anything else?
Yes.
He hesitated, then continued.
I wish to choose the time and place, Lord. Otherwise, this one of whom I speak will escape your hound through its warren of chaos. Only I can prevent that. Thus, it must be part of the deal. All that you need do is have your hounds ready. I will call upon you at the proper moment, providing you with the creature's precise location. The rest is up to your hounds.
You've planned this well, wizard, Shadowthrone said. As of yet, I can think of no way to kill both the creature and you. I commend you. How then do you intend to call upon me? Surely you'll not once again enter my realm.
Lord, you will be contacted. I guarantee this. But I can say no more about it.
And if I were to lay my powers upon you now, wizard, if I were to wring whatever lies hidden in that frail brain of yours, how would you prevent me?
To answer that, Lord, you must answer my proposal first.
Shan growled, and this time the god made no motion to still her. Quickben went on hastily.
Given that you will seek to betray me at every opportunity, given that you'll hunt for the weaknesses in my plan, given all this, I would have your word that you will complete your part of the deal if all else fails you, Lord. Give me that, and I will answer your last question.
Shadowthrone was silent for a long minute.
Ah, well, he muttered. Your cunning is admirable, wizard. I am astonished, and I must admit, delighted by this duel. My only regret is that you departed the paths of shadow. You would have risen far. Very well. You have my word. The hounds will be ready. Now, why shouldn't I shred your brain here and now, wizard?
Your answer, Lord, is in your very words.
Quickben raised his arms.
I did indeed rise far, Shadowthrone, in service to you.
He opened his warren.
You'll not have me, Lord, because you can't.
Quickben whispered his word of recall, a word born of chaos. Power burst around him, and he felt as if a giant hand had closed around him. As it pulled him back into his warren, he heard Shadowthrone's scream of recognition.
It is you, Delat, you shape-shifting bastard!
Quickben smiled. He'd done it. He was out of reach. He'd done it. Again. Crupper was ushered into Baruch's study with none of the delays he was so fond of confounding. Slightly disappointed, he took his seat and wiped his forehead with his handkerchief. Baruch entered.
You took your time getting here, he growled. Well, never mind. Have you any news?
Crupper laid his handkerchief on his lap and began carefully to fold it.
We continue to protect the coin-bearer, as instructed. As for the presence of Malazan infiltrators, No luck.
It was a major lie, but necessary.
I am to convey a message to you, he continued, most unusual in its source. Indeed, strange, in fact, was its delivery to Krupa.
Get on with it.
Krupa winced. Baruch was in a terrible mood. He sighed.
A message to you personally, master.
He completed folding his handkerchief and looked up.
From the eel.
Baruch stiffened, then a scowl darkened his features.
Why not? He muttered. The man even knows who my agents are.
His gaze cleared and he watched Krupa.
I'm waiting, he growled.
Of course.
Krupa shook loose his handkerchief and mopped his brow.
Look to the streets to find those you seek. That and no more. Delivered to Krupa by the smallest child he'd ever seen.
He stopped and shook his head. No, such exaggeration would never do, not with Baruch's mood as foul as it appeared to be.
A small child, in any case.
Baruch stood, glowering at the dying embers in the fireplace, his hands clasped behind his back, fingers twisting a large silver ring.
Tell me, Krupa, he asked slowly. What do you know of this eel?
Little, Krupa admits. Man, woman, unknown. Origins, a mystery. Designs, perpetuating a status quo defined by aversion to tyranny. Or so it said. Influence, far-reaching. Even if one discounts 9 out of 10 rumors associated with the eel, his or her agents must number in the hundreds. All devoted to protecting Darujistan. 'Tis said that Councilman Turban Orr is even now hunting them down, convinced they've ruined all his schemes. Mayhap they have, and for that we can all be relieved.
Baruch seemed anything but relieved. Krupa thought he could almost hear the man's teeth grinding. However, he turned to Krupa and nodded.
I have an assignment. For it, you will need to round up Murillo, Ralik, and Kol, and take the coin-bearer with you, just to keep him safe.
Krupa raised an eyebrow.
Out of the city?
Yes. Paramount is the coin-bearer. Keep him beyond anyone's reach. As for your mission, you will observe. Nothing more. Do you understand me, Krupa? Observe. To do anything else will be to risk the coin-bearer falling into the wrong hands. While he is Opon's tool, he also is the means by which another ascendant can reach Opon. The last thing we need is gods battling on the mortal plane.
Krupa cleared his throat.
What are we to observe, Master?
I'm not sure. Possibly a foreign work party. Digging. Here and there.
Krupa started.
As in road repairs?
The alchemist frowned.
I will be sending you to the Gadrobi Hills. Remain there until either someone comes or I contact you with further instructions. If someone comes, Krupa, you're to remain hidden. Avoid detection at all costs. Use your warren if need be.
None shall find Krupa and his worthy, loyal comrades,
Krupa said, smiling and waggling his fingers.
Good. That will be all, then.
Surprised, Krupa climbed to his feet.
When are we to leave, Master?
Soon. I'll let you know at least a day beforehand. Is that sufficient time?
Yes, friend Baruch. Krupa deems that more than enough time. Ralik appears temporarily indisposed, but with luck he shall be available.
Get him if you can. If the coin-bearer's influence turns against us, the assassin is charged with killing the boy. Does he understand this?
We've discussed it, Krupa said.
Baruch inclined his head and fell silent. Krupa waited a moment, then quietly left. Less than an hour after Quick Ben's soul had left the body seated on the hut's floor and journeyed into the Shadow Realm, it creaked back into life. Red-eyed with an exhaustion born of unrelenting tension, Kalam pushed himself to his feet and waited for his friend to come round. The assassin laid his hands on his long knives, just to be on the safe side. If Quick Ben had been taken, whatever controlled him might well announce its arrival by attacking anyone within range. Kalam held his breath. The wizard's eyes opened, the glaze slipping away as awareness returned. He saw Kalam and smiled. The assassin released his breath.
Done? Success?
Yes, on both counts. Hard to believe, isn't it? Kalam found he was grinning uncontrollably. He stepped forward and helped Quick Ben to stand. The wizard leaned heavily against him, also grinning.
He realized who I was just as I left.
Quick Ben's grin broadened.
You should have heard him scream.
Well, are you surprised? How many high priests burn the robes of their vestment?
Not enough, if you ask me. Without temples and priests, the god's bloody meddling couldn't touch the mortal realm. Now, that would be paradise, right, friend?
Perhaps, said a voice at the doorway. Both men turned to see Sori standing within the entrance, her half-cloak drawn about her slim body. She was wet with rain, and only now did Kalam notice the water dripping through cracks all around them. The assassin stepped away from Quick Ben to free his hands.
What are you doing here?
He demanded.
You dream of paradise, wizard. I wish I'd heard the entire conversation. How did you find us?
Quick Ben asked. Sori stepped inside and pushed back her hood.
I found an assassin, she said. I've marked him. He's in a place called the Phoenix Inn, in the Daru district. Are you interested?
She asked, dully eyeing both men.
I want answers, Kalam said in a low voice.
Quick Ben backed to the far wall, to give the assassin room and to prepare his spells if need be, though he was in no real shape to manage his warren at the moment. Nor, he noticed, did Kalam look up to a scrap, not that the assassin would allow that to stop him. Right now, he was at his most dangerous. That low tone had said it all. Sori held her dead eyes on Kalam.
The sergeant has sent me to you.
A lie,
Kalam interjected softly.
Whiskey Jack doesn't know where we are.
Very well. I sensed your power, wizard. It has a notable signature.
Quick Ben was stunned.
But I established a shield around this place, he said. Yes, I too was surprised, wizard. Usually I cannot find you. It seems cracks appeared.
Quick Ben thought about that.
Cracks?
He decided wasn't the right word, but Sori didn't know that. She had sensed his whereabouts because she was what they'd suspected, a pawn of the rope. The Shadow Realm had been linked, however briefly and however tenuously, to his flesh and blood. Yet none but a servant of Shadow possessed the necessary sensitivity to detect that link. The wizard moved to stand beside Kalam and laid a hand on the burly man's shoulder. Kalam threw him a startled glare.
She's right. Cracks appeared, Kalam. She's obviously a natural talent in the ways of sorcery. Come on, friend. The girls find what we've been looking for. Let's move on it.
Sori pulled up the hood around her head.
I am not accompanying you, she said. You'll know the man when you see him. I suspect it is his task to make his profession obvious. Perhaps the guild is anticipating you. In any case, find the Phoenix Inn.
What the hell are you up to?
Kalam demanded.
I will be completing an assignment for the sergeant.
She turned and left the hut. Kalam's shoulders slumped, and he let out a long breath.